What I'm going to do now, however, is replay part of the Perspective show from KSCO so people can hear Robert Whitaker. And you can also, he's online on the on this website, Mad in America, lots of audio stuff. But this is specifically, he was actually talking to a group of people in Santa Cruz. And more interesting around this issue than Robert's really always fascinating narrative is the side stuff. It actually is not side stuff. It's really, to me, the more important stuff, which has to do with the reason that this fellow who's narrating this whole show got interested in the case was because he got a call from someone on the psych ward that they were either being forcibly medicated or held against their will. And he went down to help that person, and he found that that was the case, and they were finally able to get that person to a judge and get a writ of habeas corpus granted, I think. And I wanted to get more information about how frequently this is happening in the psychiatric system in Santa Cruz. There used to be a group of people fighting very strongly against psychiatric oppression in Santa Cruz. And it's particularly pertinent because of Laura's Law, which I've mentioned in past shows, law that was recently passed, confirmed in San Francisco County, a very liberal area, relatively, and I'm afraid maybe coming to Santa Cruz, which allows for what I call needles on wheels, which forced medication, which even though it states in the law, this law does not authorize forced medication. What it does authorize, it authorizes judges to use a relaxed standard that relies on psychiatric testimony and past mental history to allow courts to mandate forced medication when people are out of the psychiatric wards. And that means they can come to your house and arrest you for not taking your meds, or force you to take your meds if there's a court order that be the case. That's my understanding of it. I'm going to be researching it further, hopefully. And let's hear some more from this show, which, as I said, will hopefully in a few months be archived on the KSCO website. Until then, you can get some bits of it now before we leave the air, or at least before I leave the air. And like that.
Special guest today is Robert Whitaker, and his website is madinamerica.com. That's mad, M-A-D, in America.com. Thanks for joining us today, everyone.
Are you there, Robert?
I am. Thanks for having me.
Very good. We're extremely happy to have Robert Whitaker on the show today. He's written a number of excellent books. One's called Mad in America, another is Anatomy of an Epidemic. I'd like everyone to relax, grab a cup of tea. Robert's quite a storyteller. His books are a very good read, and it tells the story in all of its good and bad points of the history of psychiatric care and mental hospitals in the United States. And what triggered this show was a local girl kept calling me saying she was being held against her will in a local psychiatric facility owned by the county and being drugged against her will. And I went down there out of curiosity and actually brought a law student, and he showed her how to write a writ of habeas corpus, which is a legal procedure to move yourself into the courts where you can get your day in court. And the people at the facility actually didn't let the girl go to her actual court hearing. They said they sent a representative to court saying she was trying to escape, and they didn't want her to go to the court hearing. So I thought, boy, this is really another little local agency that's out of control, maybe even worse than the planning department, who you would think would be the worst. And a number of people suggested I interview Robert Whitaker, and I'm glad we have him on the show because I was looking at his books. They're really great. Now, Robert, why don't you tell us a little about your background? How'd you get interested in this subject?
Yeah, really, sort of the back door. So my background is I was a newspaper reporter for a long time covering medicine and science. And in 1998, I was co-writing a series for the Boston Globe that was just looking at abuses of psychiatric patients in research settings. And it really was just going to be a series, and then I was going to move on to other topics. But while I was doing that series, I came upon research done by the World Health Organization, which twice found that longer-term outcomes for people diagnosed with schizophrenia were much better in the poor countries of the world, specifically India, Colombia, and Nigeria, than in the U.S. and other rich countries. And the World Health Organization actually concluded that living in a developed country is a strong predictor you won't have a good outcome. So I was rather surprised by that. And it really was, I was curious about why would living in a rich country be a predictor that you'll have a poor outcome if you're so diagnosed. I wanted to find out more about that, and that's what led me to write Mad in America.
I really like the historical development you give there, and I'm sure the listeners would love to hear the story. And I mean, it's really quite a tale going back. I mean, you can't go back thousands of years, but you go back hundreds of years, and you talk about some of the very benign and friendly and inspired treatment by Quaker groups as contrasted with almost devilish treatment by some doctors. And it runs the gamut. It's really quite a story. Would you mind going back in time a bit and telling our listeners a little about, I mean, what's the history of how did we get to where we are today, where you've got tens of millions of people on drugs?
Yeah, that's really what I was so, as I was trying to, initially in this first book, Mad America, try to solve this mystery. It became evident to me as I began to look at that, is you sort of did need to know the history of treatment of the seriously mentally ill in our country from colonial times till today, because that would reveal a lot about, you know, how society thinks about, quote, the mad in its midst, and the different approaches, different sort of legal frameworks, and that sort of thing. And what you find as you look at this history, the society's treatment of the mentally ill, it really becomes a sort of a window that looks at different sort of philosophies that are present in society at large during that time. So if you go back to the colonial times, now this really was the age of reason, and the idea was that, in a philosophical sense, the person who lost his reason, that reason was what separated man from the animal. And thus, a person who lost his reason, went mad, was seen as having sort of gone to a lower level of being, become animal-like, and therefore medicine actually devised a lot of treatments similar to how you would treat animals. In other words, the patients had to be tamed, sometimes they had to be whipped, they had to be chained. They were seen as impervious to cold and heat, and often kept nude. And, you know, the first hospital in the colonies in Philadelphia actually had cells in the basement where there was straw there as if they were taking care of animals, and that's where the mad were out. So that's our first big moment in terms of how we treat the mad. And then in the early 1800s, you get a reform movement done by the Quakers, and the Quakers reconceived of things, and they said, listen, we don't know why people go mad, but we do know they're brethren. In other words, they're not animals. And once they conceive of people as brethren, the idea is you need to treat people humanely and with kindness. And the Quakers came up with the idea of building asylums, really retreats, out in the countryside, try to provide kind care out there. And the idea was that being out in nature could help many people regain their their sanity. And it actually worked. Historians have gone back and looked at outcomes in the first half of the 1800s when this form of care was really the predominant form of care, at least for those who could afford it. And they found that more than 50% of the newly insane, and these were people who were quite crazy, so to speak, would get better in 12 to 18 months and they'd go back out into society. And the best long-term study we have of moral therapy found that more than that roughly two-thirds never came back to the asylum. And we don't get anything like outcomes like that for people diagnosed with schizophrenia today. Anyway, the next big thing is in the late 1800s, the United States started coming under the grip of ideas of eugenic ideas. And eugenic ideas really arise from Darwin's understanding of evolution. So Darwin says species evolve, and although he doesn't say anything about human species, the implication is obvious that human species, human societies evolve as well. And then Sir Francis Galton, a cousin of Darwin, said this: if a society wants to stay strong, it needs to encourage those with good germplasm to breed and to prevent those with bad germplasm from breeding. And so with this idea, basically the United States began passing laws, eugenic laws, that prevented, quote, the insane from marrying. And then next, the eugenicists said, listen, we've got to keep that bad germplasm out of our society, so we need to segregate them into hospitals and keep them there. And now all of a sudden you find under this new conception, people going into hospitals around 1900, 1910, and just staying there for decades, not being let out. And then finally, we, in 1927, the U.S. Supreme Court said it was okay to forcibly sterilize such people. And then in the 1930s, based on this devaluation of people and this idea that those with serious mental illness were a threat to society, they were a cancer on society, they had bad genes and they could, you know, spread these bad genes, in other words, they devalued their worth, we got a host of very aggressive therapies such as insulin coma therapy, metrazole convulsive therapy. Metrazole was a type of poison that caused these really painful seizures. People would crack their teeth, break their backs, that sort of thing. And ultimately, we got frontal lobotomy in which the frontal lobes were destroyed. And believe it or not, in 1949, the inventor of that surgery, which we remember today as a mutilating surgery, won the Nobel Prize in Medicine for having invented it.
One little quick note here. Is there any way of removing that Nobel Prize from him retroactively?
No, but that's what's so interesting. At the time, in the 40s, you can read articles in the New York Times and others that this was a miracle brain surgery, that the doctors had learned to pluck madness neatly from the brain without causing any harm. And there was even talk about how we didn't really need our frontal lobes. There was no real loss to these people from having their frontal lobes destroyed. And the irony, of course, is that if you put an ape brain next to a human brain, they look very much the same except for one thing. It's the frontal lobes are so pronounced in the human brain. So they literally were destroying the part that makes us most human.
It's amazing. I understand that physician, doctor, psychiatrist, he had a truck and he'd drive around the United States and give lobotomies?
Oh, that's true. Walter Freeman. So even though the person who invented the surgery was a Portuguese neurologist, Egas Moniz, but in the United States it was really promoted by a man named Walter Freeman. He was the first one to really try it. And then eventually he became convinced that he could do these very quickly, 10, 15 minutes, that they really wouldn't, they pose very little threat to a person. And he literally would go on summer tours where he would drive from mental institution or mental hospital to mental hospital. He'd show up in the morning and then the superintendent or whoever the authorities would be would line up a group of patients to be lobotomized. And he would bring them in one after another. He'd put them down on a gurney. And he developed a form of surgery where he just pounded ice picks through the eye sockets into the frontal lobes, sort of scrambled the ice picks around, and in that way destroyed the frontal lobes in about 15 minutes, and he would just get one person after another. He would do 15, 20 frontal lobotomies a day.
It's amazing. In your book, you also touch a bit about the history in Europe. And you mentioned bedlam, which I can remember even as a boy, that expression being used as, a crazy sort of situation where that devolved into almost like a zoo where people would come and stare at these people. And then you mentioned, who was it, Pinel, who was the fellow in France who tried to reforms?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you look at the reform efforts, so if you go back to those real harsh medical therapeutics, which were first in place in colonial America as well, they did arise out of medical texts in Scotland and England in madhouses in the 1600s and 1700s, and that's where the conception was of the mad as basically animals. And then you get Philippe Pinel, and it's really part of the French Revolution. He decides he's going to treat these, quote, the mad at the two asylums in Paris with humanity, tend to their emotions, and at least as the story goes, he then unchains them and lets them now wander about the asylum freely as opposed to being chained. And this is seen as the start of a reform effort to treat people more humanely. But then the people who really bring that together are the Quakers in York, England. They rebel against, they have one of their members who goes to Bedlam, in fact, dies under the care at that hospital, and they see that person chained up and all. So the Quakers in York said, we're going to build this retreat out in the countryside and treat people differently, kindly, etc. And they find that it works. Of course, it's much more humane. And then Quakers in the United States introduced that into this country. And the very first asylums were really Quaker retreats. So, for example, McLean's Hospital in Boston today is a very well-known mental institution. It was an initial Quaker retreat going back, I think it was 1816 it was started. So the origins of mental hospitals out in the country really come from the Quakers, and it was really a noble impulse to kind of start.
Now, you mentioned that I think it was Lady Dix who became quite a crusader in the United States to upgrade the mental hospitals, and actually in a way that sort of created problems because some of these very beautiful retreats got so impacted with people that the quality started to fall down.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is a part of history that is very little known in psychiatry. So we have these small retreats that open up in northeastern cities, basically. I think there was one in Virginia, too, starting around 1815, and more open up until, like, 1850. But they're small, and so the number of people they're treating is quite small, actually. And if you don't get into one of those retreats, you're very likely to be locked up to, you know, in a jail and treated badly, or even if out in the countryside, basically practically locked up in a barn. So Dorothea Dix was a teacher who had her own breakdown, a Massachusetts teacher, and then she went to England and was nurtured back to health by the very family that the William Tuke family in England, the Quakers that had developed this form of care called moral therapy, which meant tending to the emotions. And since she was brought back to health by this, and, you know, she also recognized, of course, the humaneness of it, she came back to the United States and became this great lobbyist, and she went around from state to state, and she would document, I think with some exaggeration, but the horrible conditions in jails and, say, people locked, you know, chained to trees and that sort of thing, and said, instead of that, here's this other option, this humane form of care where you build a very nice retreat out in the countryside with beautiful grounds and have people exercise and eat and provide them with good shelter. Let's do that instead. And remarkably, the building of such asylums in the 1850s in some ways was, I think, the first great public works program in the United States. In other words, societies did respond. They put a lot of money into it, given that time. But what happened is these now become public facilities, and once they become public facilities, communities begin dumping everybody into these facilities, people with, you know, dementia, neurological disorders, syphilis, and that sort of thing, and they become these big, big, and so they go from these smaller, neatly contained institutions that were supposed to take care of about 250 people into these big warehouses of 1,000, 2,000 people. And so you could no longer provide this sort of humane, very supportive care. And once that happened, and of course people stopped getting better because many of them had dementia, they were serving as nursing homes. And when that happens, that form of care, that moral therapy developed by the Quakers, was seen as a failed form of care. But really what failed was having big warehouses where you dumped all sorts of people, including people with syphilis and dementia. But that's why we lost sight of this form of humane healing care.
Now, even back then, hundreds of years ago, you know, a lot, as this show progresses, we'll get naturally to the present time where it seems like a lot of drugs are being used. But even back then, they were using drugs, or opium and morphine and things of that nature. So back then, you had some of the same dialogue you have today between humane care, where the person is left quietly to have a chance to heal themselves, versus subjecting them to a lot of forced drugs, right?
Yeah, I mean, they were always trying to find sedatives sometimes to quiet people and help them sleep and that sort of thing. Whenever they had such agents. But then what did happen, because one of the things we do want to need is we want to go forward with the introduction of the first antipsychotics, because there's a thread there, a story thread to follow. But what we do see is in the first part of the 1900s, under the eugenic attitudes towards the mentally ill, all sorts of really aggressive physical therapies tried. I mean, they would pull their teeth out. They would keep them, they would do these, basically wrap them up for hours and hours on end, very forceful, sort of water therapies. There were different types of really poisons they would give them. And all sorts of things were tried, and almost everything tried was said to be successful initially. There was one guy, Henry Cotton in New Jersey, who would even remove body parts. He would start with the teeth, and if that didn't work, he'd start removing, I don't know, other internal parts. Of course, he often killed people with his surgeries. So what you see here is when you begin to, this rises again in the 1900s, when you devalue the people, you start seeing really aggressive physical therapies, and any therapy that serves to make people quieter and less difficult to take care of is inevitably seen as successful. And that's why in the 1930s, when we get insulin, metronidazole convulsive therapy, for example, it's hailed as very, very effective. And what is it? Well, metronidazole was a poison. It caused these horrible seizures. As I said, it could break bones. What had two effects? Doctors found they could just threaten people with it and it would help quiet people because they were so afraid of it. But also, after you underwent it, it did cause some brain damage as well, and people would be quieter and more childlike as they tried to recover from that surgery. And so we got these very aggressive surgeries in the 1930s, early 1940s, and doctors at the time even wrote about how these are, and I'm talking about insulin coma therapy and even repetitive electroshock, that these therapies worked by damaging the brain, and then we get lobotomy.
So when did the electric shock start?
Around 1938, it was introduced in the United States. And it really was seen as a way to more reliably induce the seizures that metronidazole also caused. But if you go back to that original electroshock data, they talk about, when you look about how they would describe the patients, they became quieter afterwards, easier to manage, more childlike. So there was a sense that they caused a change in being, which in some ways, made them less adultish and less sort of conscious. But that change in being was seen as good by those who were running the asylum. And the other thing, of course, many people were afraid of forced electroshock as well, and so it had the place in the asylum that could be used as a punishment as well, a threat. If you don't behave, we're going to electroshock you.
Now, your description of lobotomies was very horrific. I think for the benefit of our listeners, could you please describe how horrific electroshock is?
Well, especially as, if you go back to the 1940s, it wasn't given with an anesthesia, and so people would be placed on a gurney or a cot, and then, there would be a bolt of electricity that would pass through the brain and cause a seizure. And when people came out of that, it was, and by the way, the seizure, there was no anesthetic, so you could have broken bones with this as well. It was seen as quite painful. People in the 1940s wrote about it with great fear. And the most important thing for me is also then just looking at what the doctors say happened to people that they gave electroshock to, and inevitably it was either quieter, the less trouble, some, oftentimes they're sort of childlike, and we can use this, we can threaten people with electroshock if they become too difficult. And there was also this idea that arose in the 1950s, if you could give people enough electroshocks, you could sort of reduce them back almost to a state of, almost eliminate the personality. And then as the person recovered from that trauma, a new personality would emerge. And the idea was, well, maybe this new personality will not be, as disturbed as the old one. But it was understood, all of these were grouped together, lobotomy, electroshock, as by some people as brain-damaging therapeutics. So at least when it was introduced, it was understood, that this was causing harm to the brain. And in fact, early research on electroshock compared electroshock to closed head injury, in other words, concussions, where you didn't have an open wound, but if you looked at someone who had been in an automobile accident, knocked out, and looked at the physiology of what happened to that person and compared it to someone who had had electroshock, there was a lot of the same physiological sort of comparisons to be made.
So now we're getting into a section where your two books are sort of merging together, the historical description, Mad in America. By the way, folks, we're interviewing Robert Whitaker, who's written some great books. We encourage you to look at his website, Mad in America.
that also anatomy of an epidemic. So now we're moving into the more modern period, and this is where they started using more drugs. Greg, could you?
Yeah, so I mean, I think this is something I think that's important. So in 1949, Ignaz Moniz wins the Nobel Prize in Medicine for, lobotomy. And then we get the first antipsychotic, clorpromazine, remembered as Thorazine, that's the brand name, into asylum medicine in 1954. Now, in common histories, this is remembered as an antipsychotic, in other words, a drug that is an antidote to psychosis. And in the common history, it is said this kicked off a psychopharmacological revolution, this great advance in care. And if you even think of the word antipsychotic, it's almost like it's an antibiotic, that it's fixing something wrong in the brain. But if you go back and actually read when it was introduced, it was initially heralded and welcomed into asylum medicine because it induced a chemical lobotomy, is what they described. It induced a change in being similar to what you saw with surgical lobotomy, but obviously the chemistry made it easier than doing it with the surgery. And so what did they describe patients? They described patients given Thorazine as now, shuffling along, much quieter, emotionally disengaged. A lot of the same things you saw after the surgery, people just not at all... sort of zombie-like in terms of the reaction to the world. So what happens now, if you go back in the history, you start saying, okay, well, which history really more accurately describes this drug? Is it the one that where we now believe that maybe it's an antidote to psychosis? Or really, was it a drug that blocks certain brain functions, and then by doing so, mimics some of the effects of surgical lobotomy? And what you can find when you now pursue those two tracks is the science actually confirmed the one in which you can understand why it was likened to a chemical lobotomy. So, for example, Haldol and Thorazine, what they do is they block dopamine function in the brain, and profoundly so. So what that does is that, and we have three main dopaminergic tracks in the brain. One goes to the frontal lobes. So if you shut off or diminish, the neuronal activity in that part of the brain, it is in that way similar to what happens with the surgical lobotomy. You're partially shutting down the frontal lobes. Now, we also know that people on Thorazine often have motor problems. They might develop Parkinsonian symptoms, and they might shuffle, etc. Well, Parkinson's disease results when you lose about 80% of your dopaminergic neurons in the basal ganglia. So in other words, it's a dopamine deficit disease. Well, the drugs, the reason you get Parkinsonian symptoms is they cause that same deficit in dopaminergic transmission. So the image of the antipsychotics as drugs that take hold of the nervous system and block brain function in certain areas of the brain, that's a scientifically accurate one. But historically, we tend to think of these as antipsychotics, drugs that fix some known biological problem, like an antibiotic, but the science doesn't support that that is actually the case.
We're starting to get some callers, and I would appreciate the callers to be very patient because we don't have a lot of time and there's a lot of material Robert's got to cover.
And we'll be returning to the last half of the Whitaker interview from yesterday's KSCO Perspective show, and thank you for airing that show, Perspectives, folks. That'll be on Thursday evening, probably between 6 and 8 at some point. Tune in and hear the rest of it, or check the archive at www.huffsantacruz.org under the name of the show, this show, Bathrobes, Beers, Broadsides. And I will be talking at you then at 6 o'clock on Thursday evening. You can also check out the Huff meeting at 11 o'clock on Wednesday morning. When I'll be there at 7:03 Pacific, we'll be meeting to figure out what to do next to protect the rights of poor and homeless people. Thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. Coming up next, Making Contact.
I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this